So we've got the difficult post-lunch spot, guys. We've got to get everyone pep back up again after they've eaten. But I think it should be a good panel. We've got a slightly different... I feel like the sport industry sometimes gets locked into a bubble. It doesn't really think outside itself very well. And here we have four panelists who are going to hopefully help us do that. I also used to be an entertainment journalist, so hopefully I've got a bit of my own perspective on this as well. Rather than introduce you guys myself, I'll ask you to just take a minute to, one by one, introduce yourselves and let us know how you relate to this topic.
Hello, Marcel Ridyard from AFL Architects. I generally work in the sport and leisure design sector, although we work cross-sector on master plans. Where I hope to bring some insight to this panel session is the need to keep things more intimate and local in major event design. So it's often been about the big arenas or the big stadiums, but actually there's more of a trend now to focus on the smaller venue or the smaller stadium and the community facilities. So that's what we want to bring to the discussion.
Jeff Ellis, I'm the chief exec of DF Concerts and Events. So we're primarily concert promoters in working in Scotland. We do concerts at all levels, from club up to stadium level, and we do music festivals as well. We also do some non-music events. We stage the Papal Visit a few years ago, done tall ships events, a wide variety of outdoor events. But our core business is concerts, but working at different levels. So working in arenas, and we see what's good about arenas and what's where the difficulties can be in arenas, particularly in the design and build of them. In Glasgow, we're lucky to have a great entertainment venue that was the Hydro, that was built for entertainment. It can host sport, but primarily entertainment was the main focus. We work in stadia as well, so obviously we put on concerts. We just put the Spice Girls on sale for Murrayfield, which is obviously stadium design for rugby. We're going to bring in a big pop show for that. So that's our kind of core business, and obviously festivals are very, very key to us. And we launched an urban festival, Transmit, 2 years ago. So we're going into our third year with that, which is changing the model a bit from doing a camping festival into a city centre festival.
Hi, my name is Nick Pritchard. I work at Cirque du Soleil. Most of you probably know Cirque du Soleil for the monster shows we put on that tour the world. We've got six shows permanently in residence in Vegas as well. Those shows sell upwards of 12 million tickets a year. It's a big beast. I'm in the special events division, and we are developing smaller shows for cities, regions, tourist boards, I suppose it's a Cirque Light, to answer lots of different economic and cultural needs. And we're developing these following a case study we have had over the last 6 years in Andorra, and another local one in Canada as well, which I'll tell you about later on.
Good to see you, colleagues. Thanks for inviting me. Martin Rees, I'm the chief executive at Coventry City Council. I've been for a decade. Just a very quick biogas to why I'm A, interested, and B, think got some credibility to hopefully stimulate some of the debate this afternoon. Over 20-odd years ago, did some doctoral research on the impact economically of large-scale hallmark events at Loughborough University, so that was an academic background. And then since my time, certainly in Coventry as a host city, I led the 2012 host city response for Coventry, then was, right from day one, involved on the big committee for Birmingham 2022, including working with Neil, who we heard from earlier on, and also led the bid for the successful UK City of Culture, which is coming to our city and the region in 2022. So hopefully got some credibility in terms of what we've been doing on the ground as a host city, and probably want to share, actually, as we get through the discussion, the fact that actually the way in which our communities and host cities, politicians, whether it be direct elected mayors, local politicians, national politicians, are seeing stuff now, it's all greying. The boundaries are completely going now between the notion of sport, physical activity, animation, experience. They're all being completely greyed. And if I don't get a chance to say it later, I'll say it now. This has got an opportunity, all of this discussion, to shine a beacon on some of our places at a time when it's pretty crap in some of that. Despite those of us who are flying at the moment, it's tough at the moment in our communities. But that's a heady responsibility if a lot of these events and a lot of these experiences end up being disconnected from the people they're meant to be celebrating with and creating a legacy for. So hopefully we'll get into some of that.
Yeah, I think we'll come back to that. I want to start with, because it strikes me that I've never done one of these in an amphitheatre before. This is a bit unusual. And we were talking outside earlier about venue design and how that influences the way an event takes place and how it happens. Marcel, I guess you're the probably best place, given that you work in architecture, to comment on this. What's the differences in venue design? How do they influence the way that an event performs itself?
Okay, so traditionally, a lot of big event spaces are designed around sport. And this has then led them, the cities, to have these empty venues, and what can you do with them? And then they start to generate touring shows. Manchester Arena is one of those examples in the UK that started primarily as an ice arena, and in the end has ended up almost not a night free in the year, full of events and exhibitions. Sport is barely played there. So what we're finding now is that, in fact, what you should do is start to design for the event that's likely to be there. So you design for music and entertainment, exhibition, conferences, and by the way, you can also do sport there, and you just kind of flip that around. And that means lots of moving walls, moving seats, flexible planning, and what's most important is discussion with operators and the people who are going to use the building. There were discussions earlier about overlay and the fact that there aren't enough discussions about that process. It's the same discussion, it's the same issue with permanent buildings. You need to have those discussions early.
Martin, can I throw that down to you? Because obviously, overseeing a city's strategy for events, when you're arranging for a venue to host events, what's your thinking behind its flexibility and whether you're going to design it for a primary or a multiple types of events?
I mean, the truth is you try and future-proof as far as you possibly can. I guess in some ways, artists, agents and others, and certainly audiences will be the ones that ultimately pass the test or not. But certainly in the Ricoh Arena, as one of our multi-event entertainment sports arenas in Coventry, a well-designed, well-thought-through space that can do everything from Peppa Pig to, top Rolling Stones type gigs. So I think my point earlier on was that people are now going through data is everything. Data, animation, experience in that space is everything. And they're not differentiating actually between the different spaces. The bowl will be for certain things, yes, but actually the whole area is one that the experience is absolutely what matters. The other thing I'll chuck into the debate, and this is for all host places, cities, small, we're talking about some of the great stuff that Cirque's doing in smaller venues. We don't think enough about particularly urban space. And we don't think about even some grotty urban space and what you can do with that to create an amazing animation experience. So not just pop-up, but actually thinking structurally about how you can use meantime strategies for having quite significant events, actually, within city centres or even in peripheral areas. We're kind of a bit devoid of imagination sometimes, and we default, if I'm honest, to the formula of bricks and mortar, built facilities, some of which actually aren't as multifaceted as somewhere like the Ricoh, and wonder why the experience isn't as good as it should be. So I'd urge all of us just to think, even if it's slightly higher cost, about how we can create meaningful spaces for events, animation within our areas, rather than just the usual response.
I think that's probably quite a nice moment to pass it on to Nick, because you've got a very interesting story about the way that Cirque is developing its strategy and using Andorra being a quite an unusual place to host these kind of events, and the way that that's changed tourism and the way that it's changed how people are visiting a place.
Yes, about 5 years ago, we were approached by the mayor of Andorra. A typical Cirque story, no one knows why, when, how. He probably met someone on a plane somewhere, going somewhere. Anyhow, it's now a wonderful case study. They came to us because in the summer months, people come in, buy duty-free, and they leave. And they wanted an event to make people stay the night. So we developed a bespoke show about the mountains, Andorra's in the mountains, that went for a month long, 21 performances, that didn't start till 10:45 at night, which fits in with the local summer way they live, but makes people who come and stay have to stay the night. 5 years on, this show now is a regular festival, a regular event. It is. If you've ever been to Andorra, Andorra's in a valley. There's one flat area in the city or in the town, in the whole area, which is an old car park. We put a marquee up there. Fits 5,000 people a night, 3,000 sitting, 2,000 standing. And Andorra, we go in, literally go and do a show there, gets people to stay, and they've had 600,000 people staying. They say for every euro they invest, they make 9 euros. And it's a part of a whole culture. Now, they do lots of things around it. But back to your early question about the whole design of places to appear in, we're very flexible. So if Andorra had a different area, we change that format. We have it in the round sometimes. We have people sitting in front of them. We have people, we change it every year there. But we're very flexible. And at the moment, we are going to smaller areas. We're in India at the moment in a very small location, because it just suits the locality and the people.
Yeah, Jeff.
I was going to say to add to that, there is a great opportunity with brownfield sites. You know, if you've got a development plan, as you were alluding to at the start there, you know, if you know, it could be you're building an arena in 2 years' time, or you're utilising some space in the future. In that intervening period, it can become a really exciting event space, you know, albeit, you know, a temporary event space. And that can be really attractive to commercial promoters, because if you have that dialogue with people in your city or your country that, you know, stage events, we're always looking for somewhere unique, either for a one-off, which, you know, could be a marquee going in somewhere, you know, and like a Cirque du Soleil or Fresa Bruta kind of experience, or, you know, it could be a series of gigs. And what people like, and particularly artists, you know, musicians, they like to do something different that has a one-off feel about it. And again, for audiences to go and say, oh, we went to that. I mean, we years ago, we set up a big marquee, and we lost a load of money on it. We set up a big marquee at Battersea Power Station. It's sponsored by Midland Bank in the early 90s. But as a venture, it's something completely different. No, it's the largest indoor arena at the time that we put up there. And yeah, if we'd had a bit more joined up thinking with the local council and everything, and made the accessibility much better, you know, that you weren't walking through radioactive kind of puddles to get to the event, it perhaps might have sold a bit better. But as an experience, it was something quite unique. Now, you know, that was, you know, a long time ago. Now I think people are more forward thinking in their ideas. But certainly, you know, if you've got a space, you know, utilize it, approach people and say, look, you know, this is here. Don't try and maximize the revenue out of the rental. Just, you know, offer up the space. Other people will take the risk on it if they can get a return on it. And it does create something special and unique. And that, from a tourism point of view, is a great way to bring people in, because you can do something on of scale that becomes attractive.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're hearing here is that it doesn't necessarily matter what the space is that you have, but you need to use it in the right way. So what are the trends that are emerging at the moment? What are the kind of events that are most attractive to cities? And I want to focus actually particularly on smaller cities, like Glasgow, that don't necessarily have the kind of London-sized population and don't necessarily have an audience who will flock to any event. What are the kind of events that you're seeing are being most attractive to a general audience?
Well, for us, you know, music is the biggest kind of driver for events, and you know, we do two urban festivals in Glasgow. One called Glasgow Summer Sessions in Belahouston Park, which is a, you know, lovely leafy park that's not used a great deal. We're going to do four shows in it this August, 35,000 capacity. But the main thing we've created, which has kind of transformed the way people look at festivals now in the UK, is the Transmit Festival on Glasgow Green, where, you know, working in partnership with the council, we've developed a product that's very special. You know, it's you know, two main stages and a, you know, very small third stage, an acoustic stage, but it's bringing, you know, 50,000 people in a day. into the city centre. Now, a good chunk of those are people who live in the city or you know, within a 20, 30-mile radius. But a lot of people are coming from the rest of the UK, certainly the rest of Scotland, and some as an international audience. So for the city, the economic impact is huge. We've got TV coverage as well, which, again, puts out a great representation of Glasgow, which, you know, a lot of people still see Glasgow as being no mean city, as it was in the 60s. So, you know, events where somebody else, you know, as in, you know, my company, are taking a commercial risk on it, bringing in international talent and bringing in audiences to come and experience that event. They're experiencing the city at the same time, so they go away with a really positive view of the city. Whereas, you know, we kind of always used to rely on our main camping event, MT in the Park, historically, which was, you know, fantastic for us, you know, 23 years. But, yeah, and that huge economic impact to the country, but not to any specific city, because obviously most of the people were staying in tents on the campsite. Now with Transmit, people are staying in Airbnb, budget hotels, right up to, you know, five-star hotels in the city. And, you know, they might not, whilst we're on for 3 days, well, last year we had 6 days, but normally we'd do 3 days. On the, not everybody comes every single day for live music. Sometimes they'll spend the rest of the time shopping or going to the theatre or going to, you know, nightclubs. So they're engaging with what else the city has on offer. So we use the city to help us sell tickets, and by bringing those people in, you know, the economic impact and the cultural impact for the city is, you know, is significant.
Martin, yeah, Coventry, so obviously.
Just quickly, then, because it goes on the back of what Jeff said in terms of what's on point at the moment and what needs to be on point. So if you go away from the venues per se and come back to this space issue in our city centres, so Coventry, you know, about 360,000, so pretty big city but very compact. Those of us who know it, those who are outside the UK, will only know us probably for the fact we are Car City, home of Jaguar Land Rover, Aston Martin, great heritage of car making. Car, you know, Motorfest, as a speeding of cars around the ring road, which is quite famous in Coventry as a tight ring road, has gone from literally nothing, just a little idea, to over 120,000 people coming into the city centre. And the reason this works, not just financially, but as Jeff said, it's bringing people into their city centre and also visitors from elsewhere in the country to spend money, yes, but also captive audience. So everything from the kids underneath the ring road, linked to the F1 in schools engineering project, having a look at what's under the bonnet of some of these amazing cars. But the reason it works is authenticity. It's going back to a certain degree of some of the heydays of fast Jaguars going around the ring road and looking great. But actually, it's about projecting forward for the youngsters and for other visitors to say, actually, we're now creating the fastest electric cars in the world going around the same ring road, and you can watch it. And that experience about authenticity, about remembering what we were about, but actually projecting forward, is really on point. Sponsors are really interested in it. Schools have engaged. People have come out. And it works. And at the same time, it comes back to the sport meets culture meets animation. There's a little folk festival that goes on at the same time. We've got public health people there because they've got a captive audience for people that often don't come into the city centre to talk to them about health and well-being. It works on every single level, and we need to have more things like that.
It's important also to create a multifaceted strategy so that you're not just hosting one kind of event, but as Jeff says, you're hosting events that bring people in, and then they may stay and they go for live music, then to the theatre, then maybe to some sport. I mean, how do you go about crafting that kind of strategy? Martin?
Are you still on me? I thought it was bored of me talking.
Just for now.
I'm flying back straight after. I'm just going to get my money's worth. So you kind of answered the own question. The worry I have for host cities, not just in the UK but internationally, is going for some of the shiny things. It's a bit of a magpie type effect. I want one of those. There's a bidding process. I must go for it. You've got, as a city, genuinely, to have an event strategy, a regeneration strategy, which is not based on a couple of 2 years of reflex tactical bidding. It's based on 10, 15, 20 years of physical, social, and economic regeneration of your place, of which events, in the way that we've said, are a central, not a peripheral part of how you make your place prosperous, much more attractive to inward investors and international visitors. So the first thing you do is create the events genuinely, as we did in Coventry 10 years ago, as event central, as an essential part of what we're about as a city, and everything hangs around that. Then you create a tourism strategy, boring but necessary, an infrastructure strategy. Have you got enough hotels? a road strategy to make sure you can get people around, a digital strategy to make sure that people have got the best animation experience and we can capture the data, and so on and so on. And also a capital investment strategy which says, do you know what? If you're going to create an event environment as a host city, you have to pay the money. You have to actually create an environment where to invest in capital and revenue to deliver this kind of return, you need brave politicians, you need to follow it everywhere. Because otherwise you look amateurish, you get poor product, and you actually get people voting with their feet.
Just to add to that, I mean, this show we do in Andorra is very different from the big shows that go into the big cities. It's a smaller show, smaller city, but then the artists are much more linked to the city. We're doing 5 years now in the region, and we now have schools coming to rehearsals, we have auditions for locals, we run apprenticeship schemes. So it's linked with all the other programs that Andorra are doing, their local government as well, and that actually motivates a lot of our artists, motivates our creatives, and it's the way we're going. So we have the big beast doing the big shows that everyone wants to see, then we're starting to do more of these, and it's rewarding all around. Works.
When you're taking Cirque to a new city or a new territory, how are you selling it to these? Do you have to sell it, or do they come to you and say, we want to put this on? Or are you trying to sell the economic benefits of this to a city?
Well, there's lots of benefits, but as we've heard earlier on, you've got to be brave to do it. You know, a councillor, you know, if it doesn't work year one, will no doubt be pulled over the coals. This has been going for 5 years. I think year one it did all right. Year five, Andorra publishing wonderful things saying how well it works. It's because they've established it. It's been a long-term policy, and it works. They now really, really exploit it as a jewel in their crown. Now, you need that type of commitment, and you need people to be brave. Because a Cirque show, we're going to turn up with something that's weird. That, you know, it ain't what you want. It's going to be odd. It's going to be crazy, but it's going to pack them in. We know that.
Marcel, turning up with something that's weird, how do you prepare a venue for that? How do you prepare a venue to be multifaceted and to be able to deal with any kind of event that a city or a events promoter might want to throw at it?
Well, if we take Hull Venue as an example, the main thing we did was bring in people like yourselves, people who put on gigs, people who put on music and entertainment. We spoke very early on to lots of operators. SMG now run it, but we spoke to the panoply of companies out there, some more theatrically based. So Swansea, we're working on at the moment, that's a much more theatrically based operator. So they have slightly different requirements. Essentially, it's the same kind of building type, but they're going to put more theatrical musical shows on. They will still do the touring gigs as well. So it's very important you talk to everyone and bring them on board. Things like how high should the rigging be? What's the height of the space? There isn't actually any guideline out there. There is no one book. People have been talking about UEFA and FIFA earlier. We work with those a lot. And there's lots of regulations, and it's all written down. For music and entertainment, it isn't actually, there is no book. So it's talking, it's getting the experts in, and by all means, of all the most important things is flexibility. So it's you put those in, but you don't rule out other things.
And that's the solution, is flexibility, rather than designated specialised venues that really only host one thing.
Well, certainly for Hull, the problem with Hull could be that you build this white elephant, which they can't fill, or it's half empty. At the moment, as far as I'm aware, it's sold out every time there's an event on. And it's better to have 3 nights of a gig, 3,500, that's almost 10,000 people over 3 nights. Leeds can do that in one night, but 3,500 people coming into Hull city centre is perfect for the nighttime trade, the nighttime economy. So it's almost better to have a smaller venue, city centre based, and a huge one miles out of town. And I know various cities in Britain are going through that issue with arenas.
Yeah, adaptability and scalability are key, because you know not every show is going to do 10,000-12,000 people, and if your venue looks dead with you know 5,000 people in it, the atmosphere, the customer experience is not going to be good. And that's a big change in Glasgow. And Glasgow went from the old SCCC halls, which are just exhibition halls, that then used to stage concerts that had no atmosphere and the audience experience was poor and it's really hard to sell tickets. With the advent of the Hydro, audiences love it. So you put on a show and you can actually sell more tickets than you think the artist is worth, which is rare. but it's also scalable and it looks good on 5,000 people because in the design it was built in that not every show is going to do 12,000, which is the capacity. So you design in for making it work and look good and have the audience experience great, you know, and the artist going away going, I just played a sold out show. It was to 50% of what the venue can hold, but it felt sold out and looked good, and that was key, and that's why it's successful. That's why it's really hard to get a date now there, because it works for comedy, it works for music, but also it works for sport. You know, Andy Murray's had some fantastic nights in there. So I think that you know, you mentioned flexibility, but scalability is important too, because you know different. You know, sport and entertainment has different audience appeals and music. You know, you can have a strong tour doing 5,000 people throughout the UK or doing, you know, 12,000 people throughout the UK. And if you can host both and that audience experience be great with both, then you're on to a winner.
Martin.
So I think the harsh reality of what happens in large global cities as compared to the small and medium-sized cities of which many of you would have worked as hosts, the large globals, through their infrastructure and through their funding, would be able to accommodate within a city centre environment and on the outer limits, a symphony hall, acoustically amazing and built for exactly that purpose. Specific sports arena, ice hockey, other indoor type arena, a popular music venue, theatres, cinemas, etc. But the reality for most cities in the UK and overseas is actually you're going for this flexible space for a number of reasons. Capital costs, but also in terms of revenue, you've got to find a way to make sure that you can de-risk wherever you can and create the yield and the revenue return to justify the decision that you're actually making to invest in the first place. That's the reality. So we come back to, we've never got enough specialist facilities. We've never not got enough multi-purpose, we'd like to have more. So you're back to the creativity, as Jeff and others have said, around brownfield, around even when many of our cities that you'll be familiar with in the UK are knocking stuff down at the moment. Question, how do we use urban fabric and almost pre-construction sites to do something really interesting? You see very little of it. You see a response immediately and hold to some interesting stuff as city of culture to use pop-up space, meantime space. We need that to happen more creatively. We need people, including in the audience here, to think about what the risk, reward, investment model looks like for doing more of that in our great cities.
Yeah, I mean, that brings me on nicely to, this year I oversaw the Sport Business Ultimate Sport City Awards, which saw Glasgow win the award for the best small city for hosting sport events in the world. And one of the factors behind that was that Glasgow has a really nicely joined up strategy between entertainment, between hospitality and sport. It brings them all together and it has an overarching strategy. How crucial is that for a city? I mean, Coventry is a good place for us to start again. How crucial is that to bring everything together and to consider a city hosting events as a holistic thing, not thinking of sports, entertainment and all these other things separately?
You've got to, for the reasons I said, it's an ultra competitive environment, but actually people don't differentiate in the way that the old segments of industry used to suggest. So if you don't do it as a city, only one thing will happen. You will cannibalise your own market and you'll cannibalise your own offer, which is just ridiculous in terms of audience, in terms of investment. And the other thing I would add to that in terms of a new mature way, links a bit to the session before lunch around learning and reimagining the future. We've got to grow up, certainly in the UK, and think less about zero sum. The truth here is we are in a competitive environment. We saw that for UK City of Culture. We saw it for Commonwealth Games. We get that. However, we're now thinking much more about regions. So as well as being joined up within our host city environment, we need to be much more magnanimous and understanding of the wider regional areas. In other words, in my patch, how are we going to be not in the same market but collaborative with the NEC, for example? And not getting into this ridiculous, again, cannibalising of a regional market because we're falling out of each other. That doesn't mean to say we have to have a single marketing strategy necessarily, but it does mean we grow up on overspill space and thinking about programming and content in a more grown-up way. That's the future of where we're going.
Marcel, I was looking the other day, and it was part of my research for this, I did some research, I think 4 or 5 of the top 10 busiest indoor arenas in the world are all in the UK. Glasgow Hydro is one, Manchester MEN is another. The O2, there are a couple more. What's the difficulty in working in an environment outside of the UK and other countries where the appetite for live events isn't possibly what it is here?
Okay, that's quite a complex question because there's 7 billion people out there. What we tend to find is that every country and region, and therefore your clients,
have a different reason to build a host venue or a host space or host events. So you'll go to a city with all this information, all this talent that we've seen today, all these great people who've delivered all these amazing events. You'll turn up to some countries in the, you know, some of the old, the like Azerbaijan, Turkmenistan, and they have a very different attitude to it. Still very much the power play of we want to put on a great event and be a world global leader, but they're not thinking about the community and engagement and creating a business plan. So you say, how many boxes do you want in this sport venue? And they said, we don't know how many boxes we want. Do we even sell boxes? You know, that's a corporate thing that we have in America, in the UK, and in Europe. But some countries just don't work like that. They don't sell the space. Some of them just, they just want the venue. So I think that you can't just say there's one solution. And I don't think each country is the same. I think, like you're saying, in Andorra and in Spain, the nighttime economy in Spain is completely different to the UK. It's all about the nighttime. So you go, you know, you said it's a late concert. That's the beginning of the night for, you know, so they would be out till 7 in the morning, perhaps. So you have to approach each city differently and advise them differently. But it's what's most important is that you do encourage that flexibility and the ability to engage.
Nick, same question to you, I suppose, on the kind of rights holder sort of side of things. What are the challenges for you when you're going into different territories? What are the learning curves when you're going to somewhere quite different? Like, I mean, you mentioned Quebec and you mentioned India.
Well, actually, I'm going to do a different example. We're talking to Georgia at the moment, Tbilisi. And Tbilisi are interested in having a show because there's nothing. There's a country of 3 million people. They have 7 million tourists coming from Russia, Turkey, Iran, and Armenia mostly, so completely new for us. And they wanted us to come in and do a show, or we're in early days of talking, and we went on a site visit recently, and they were talking about taking a concert area that has 10,000 people or building something for us. Anyhow, we knew, we'd done some research, and we found there's an old circus in the centre of Tbilisi. It's a 120-year-old building, beautiful old building, and it's been falling apart. And we've said it has a maximum of 1,800 people, but it's a stunning building. We're saying to them at the moment, let's renovate that, revive this area, revive the history of the circus. It'll motivate us, it'll motivate you. It's a very different show. It's in the round. It's a proper old circus. And it's really funny. The guy who owns it, when we went to see it, it's a stunning Art Deco place, but it's falling apart. But it just needs less, you know, than building a whole new place. As we went in, he said, of course, you bring all your animals in from here. And we looked at him and said, we don't have animals. And he just looked at us and went, you're not a circus. He said, yeah. And he didn't have a clue. But it's a great place. So, I mean, everywhere is different. And we're very flexible, as I said before. And we don't look for anything. But, I mean, when you find something like that, you just latch onto it. It's stunning. It's just a great place. Go and have a look on Google at the Tbilisi, the circus. It's just great. And run by this funny old man who still thinks we're going to bring animals along.
I mean, that's a really good example of, I mean, quite literally, events being used to regenerate a space or regenerate a city. Martin, how some different ways that you've tried to do the same thing, that you've tried to bring in events that have helped to regenerate the, particularly the city centre of Coventry, and make people bring people into the centre of the city more?
Yeah, so we've talked about Motorfest, which has become an incredibly important event for the city centre. We've also always been, slightly out of city centre, always been very proud of the Godiva Festival, which I think, in terms of music, is still one of, if not the largest, free family festival in the country. And that brings mainly Coventrians and the immediate region to celebrate the place, because the real key for our city, and it's true of many others that will be represented here, perceptions often aren't negative of our places, and particularly our city centres. They're often just neutral for those that haven't visited. So the real key about this is, if it's an empty vessel almost, is get people in, particularly new people, friends, families, preferably investors and agents and people that are literally making notes. Get them in and then convert them. So my answer to your question is, I don't think we should over-worry and spin on design too much about this perfectly choreographed set of events. Get people in with something a bit different, a bit unusual, and accept the fact that in doing so, you will fail, and there will be some stinkers sometimes where you'll lay something on which you think will be really attractive to bring people in and draw them in, but actually it's miserable failure. But be comfortable about that, because actually, unless you experiment, you're going to struggle and end up with a very mediocre vanilla program. So get people in, then they can make their own decisions, as they do for many of our great cities in the UK, which is, wow, I didn't realise just how amazing the core of that city is, the history, the heritage, the things that are there for myself, my family. I'm coming back. That's economic vitality, which starts with an event, starts with animation, starts with something visceral that ends up with something long-term.
Marcel, do you want to comment on the same issue?
Yeah, in Manchester for the Commonwealth Games back in 2002, which for many years seemed like just the other year. But anyway, that's life. You suddenly realise it's now over 15. But what that event did for Manchester, I'm seeing similarly in Hull. So when I was working in Manchester on the Commonwealth Games Stadium, you saw people take pride in their own city. There's a lot of talk today about tourists coming in, but actually you forget your biggest tourist is your own citizen. And once people in Manchester started taking pride in their city centre again, because they were so amazed by the event, it transformed the whole daytime and nighttime economy. And currently in Manchester, the Manchester International Festival has come out of that spirit. So it's basically, that's its legacy from that event. They run that every 2 years. It's biannual, may go annual, but to keep it fresh, they tend to keep it biannual. Hull, again, same thing. I mean, Hull actually is the city centre. You should go to it if you haven't seen it. It is actually a stunning architectural and exciting place. It tends to get maligned. Everyone says, oh, Hull's dull, but it's not. It's actually a really charming city. And the counterpoint to Liverpool, it was a massive trading city back in the heyday. So what the City of Culture done is allowed the people, it's a great example, and I presume similar will happen in Coventry, bringing the people were so much involved in Hull, and will be in Coventry. And if you bring the people with you, they actually are part of the event. So there was one example in Hull where all the inhabitants of a tower block were engaged to decorate it and light it up, and it became this huge show. And it was the people in that tower block, which for years people had said, oh, it looks a bit miserable, suddenly was the centre of world news, you know, for that moment. And I think if you engage the people, the spaces, and your local inhabitants, they are the biggest exponents of tourism for your city.
All right, we're getting the wrap-up. I'm going to pass to you for one last question. We've done the whole panel without really mentioning sport very much, which I think is quite good at this conference. What's something that you would say that sport can learn from the live entertainment event space that sport hasn't done so well, and it could look to what you do and pick up from?
I think it's the audience experience, which goes beyond the 90 minutes or whatever the length of the sporting activity is. And maybe as an example, I'd use my club, Manchester City, you know, with their ground to get people in early. They've developed this City Square concept where they put on live bands, you know, of a good level as well, and have interviews with past players, sometimes from both clubs, and people arrive earlier and make more of the experience. So they're arriving, they're obviously spending money on the F&B, which is a benefit to the club. It helps manage the you know, arrivals and dispersion of people as well, because it's open after the games. But it prolongs the event, and it's more welcoming for away fans as well as for home fans. What Scotland doesn't allow alcohol at football matches still, and I see that as a negative, because the experience you're giving, you're saying to people, well, we don't trust you to drink alcohol. They're all drinking alcohol before the game and after the game. Why not serve it to them? You know, I don't mean as a match is going on, but you know, pre and post game inside a stadium. It will get people in earlier, it'll produce more revenue for the clubs, and actually audience behaviour, as is proven in England, will be enhanced, it'll be improved, because people aren't stocking up and downing a load of drinks and then heading to the ground. They're drinking in a controlled environment with police and stewards around. The sale of alcohol is controlled, naturally controlled by the space and the queues. You're not serving high-strength spirits. So, you know, football in Scotland as an experience can be transformed overnight, but so many people against doing it because they go, oh, what if people misbehave? Well, guess what? They can misbehave anyway, whether you serve them alcohol in the stadium or not. So improve the experience. And I guess the key thing, and I mentioned it earlier on when we were talking, is a spectacle. And for an artist, if I can share this experience, and you know, if you ask an artist what do they prefer to do, do they prefer to play a small club or big arena or stadium, they generally say, well, the intimacy in a small venue you can't replicate anywhere else, and that's true. But for an art, you know, artists don't make a living by playing small venues. They make a living by playing big arenas and big stadiums, and that's a spectacle that they bring to the show. So that's all the bells and whistles, the dancers. You know, if any of you saw the Beyoncé and Jay-Z tour, it was phenomenal. You didn't have to be a big fan of Beyoncé and Jay-Z's music. It was a spectacle. It was a dance show. It was a theatrical show, it was a pyrotechnic show, it was, you know, a great experience, as well as being a, you know, a damn good concert. And that spectacle in stadiums really brought to life the whole experience, and people went away really enthused about it. Now, obviously, with sport, you know, you can't, you know, pre-arrange how good the sport is going to be, but if you put the environment, if you make the environment one that's conducive to get audiences in earlier, to be more engaged and to witness a spectacle, not just the performance, you know, and you know, at football stadiums that can be, you know, dimming the lights before kickoff and just creating a real sense of spectacle. So it's always thinking about the audience and not just the, you know, the participants, and getting the audience in and out. It's create that spectacle, create a life-affirming moment, and people will come back and experience it again and again.
All right, great. I'm afraid, thanks to my bad time management, there's no time for questions, but the guys will be around afterwards, except Martin, who's flying off. But if you want to ask the rest, they'll be around. Thank you, and thank you to the panel.